You are here with us right now, about to get the updates you eagerly wait for every month on Alzheimer's disease research. A whole episode dedicated to assessing neurocognitive domains for screening and diagnostics. Learning and memory, executive function, perceptual and motor skills. You got it. That's right. And that's coming up right now. Welcome to Aminder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible. Hello, friend. This is Sarah Luigi, your host for this episode on clinical assessment in Alzheimer's disease. What a joy and privilege it is to be speaking to you on a topic I find super relevant and applicable. I did my master's work on amyloid beta aggregation kinetics and neuroinflammation, and now I'm focusing on a more clinical path in medical school. My involvement as a host at Aminder reflects the switch, as I used to host the episodes on A-beta-mediated pathology and the immune system, and I'm now focusing on cognitive assessment. So perhaps you'll find my voice familiar. Today I'm covering abstracts published in June 2022, where researchers try to develop or refine clinical assessment tools. You may have noticed that I said I am covering abstracts, not papers. This is what we do at Aminder. We conduct a search on PubMed using the word Alzheimer. We download all the abstracts for the primary papers that result from the search. We sort them into distinct categories. We shape these episodes. Then we summarize them for you in these flash news-like podcasts. If a paper catches your interest, you can find the full citation in our numbered bibliography linked in the show notes. The goal is not to replace the process of reading and critically appraising these papers. We want to help you keep up with what's out there so you don't have to do those tedious searches on PubMed and skim through hundreds of titles and abstracts. I have to thank Ellen Rowe for conducting the search every month and the team members who processed hundreds of abstracts published in June 2022, categorized them by AMN methods all of last month. And that would be Eden Dubchak, Ben Cornish, Nyla Coleman, and myself. Our team is big, international, and made of wonderful scientists who deeply care about science communication. If this resonates with you, consider joining us. Get in touch on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn, or send us an email at aminderpodcast@gmail.com. Think about it and get in touch. Perhaps this selection of summaries will tickle your fancy, or even intrigue you and draw you to considering our invitation. This episode is dedicated to abstracts where researchers look at neurocognitive domains to better detect Alzheimer's disease or distinguish it from other forms of dementia. So this will be particularly relevant to you if you do any work on clinical assessment, or if you're interested in neurology, neuropsychiatry, or geriatrics. Only 7 papers made it here. So while this will be a short episode, I'm also excited about the opportunity to give more background before and in between summaries. I hope this will help you make sense of the terminology and also help ease you into the field if you're new. Some of it will sound familiar, as fortunately, the definition of neurocognitive domains does not change month to month, but I'll try my best to keep it interesting. If you're new to the field and are wondering what I mean by neurocognitive domains, here's a brief introduction. But if you're ready to jump in right to the abstracts, you can skip to the first section of our summaries, and timestamps are available in our show notes to help you with this. When we talk about cognition, especially in neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease, we may think about learning and memory, which are indeed very important aspects of our cognitive functioning, and functioning in general. This includes working memory, short-term memory, or long-term memory. Then we further categorize long-term memory into implicit, like procedural and priming, or explicit, like declarative and semantic memory. This becomes relevant when we look at specific subfields in the hippocampus, for example, what type of memory is affected or spared in injury. In Alzheimer's disease, we typically see a decline in working memory and long-term declarative memory. With this said, cognitive functioning is not limited to learning and memory. There are 5 other neurocognitive domains in the DSM-5 classification. Language is one of them, and for this we can test someone's ability to find words, name objects, or even their speech fluency and grammar. A third domain is executive function, and this is important for planning and decision making. Then perceptual motor function, like visuospatial perception and motor coordination. Attention is another neurocognitive domain and refers to how we can selectively focus on tasks or objects. And last but not least is social cognition, like how we recognize and regulate our emotions. This classification is based on the DSM-5 approach, and you can read more on it in the paper Classifying Neurocognitive Disorders, the DSM-5 Approach by Parminder and colleagues, published in 2014 in Nature Reviews Neurology. We can test these domains separately or together with assessment tools that follow an interview style or involve tasks like drawing or moving or recall. I hope I didn't bore you with this general introduction. In this episode, we'll be going through abstracts organized in 3 sections. The first 5 abstracts being for learning and memory, then 1 abstract for executive function, and 1 last one for perception and motor function. However, this is not just it for this month. There are 9 other papers published on cognitive testing, but these will have to wait for another episode. If you're interested in cognitive assessment that looks at the bigger picture and combines multiple cognitive domains, tune in September for part 2 of this episode. And there's more! Papers looking at clinically significant markers with a focus on activities of daily living and harnessing technology for better screening. As for research on behavioral, physiological, and genetic markers for diagnostics, make sure you check our bibliographies accessible through our site. Okay, let's get to the meat of this episode, starting with learning and memory, with paper titled Contribution of Memory Tests to Early Identification of Conversion from Amnestic Mild Cognitive Impairment to Dementia. This one was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease by first author Benalek, last author is Hort, and they're affiliated with Charles University in Prague, St. Anne's University Hospital in the Czech Republic as well, University of South Florida in Tampa, and University of California in California. Some tests used to assess memory rely on the controlled encoding and cued recall paradigm, or otherwise called CECR. And previous research seems to support their role in detecting Alzheimer's disease in its early stages. But how does it compare to other tests? This is the question the authors of this paper tackle here. To track the conversion from amnestic mild cognitive impairment to dementia, they administer a comprehensive neuropsychological assessment to 270 amnestic MCI patients, and these tests include, okay, bear with me, they include the Enhanced Cued Recall Test, or ECR, and a memory test with CECR, the Auditory Verbal Learning Test, or AVLT, logical memory test, a visuospatial memory test called the Ray-Osterrieth Complex Figure Test, and cognitive testing based on the Uniform Dataset Battery. They found that 53% of the participants developed dementia, most of whom had Alzheimer's disease. Huh. The usual value I see around in literature is a conversion of 10 to 15% from amnestic MCI to Alzheimer's disease, so 53 is a lot. They also reported that the delayed recall scores on AVLT and the logical memory tests were the best predictors of this conversion. They concluded that the tests reliant on the CECR, or the controlled encoding and cued recall paradigm, was not better than the other tests employed in this study in predicting the conversion from amnestic MCI to dementia. They also highlight the value of using cued recall in this assessment. If you're interested in the value of the auditory verbal learning test and how well it correlates with CSF, Alzheimer's disease biomarkers, I covered a paper on this with Bruno and Mueller last month, so make sure you check that episode as well. Now moving on to abstract 2 of this episode, titled Subjective Short Memory Difficulties at Ages 50 to 75 Predict Dementia Risk in a Community-Based Cohort Followed Over 17 Years. It was published in Aging by Mollers and Brenner, who are affiliated with the German Cancer Research Center in Heidelberg, as well as Heidelberg University, also in Germany, Max Planck Institute of Psychiatry in München, Medical University of Vienna, and Saarland Cancer Registry. All of these are in Germany. Subjective memory decline comes up almost every month. But if this is new to you, note that subjective cognitive decline refers to a decrease in cognitive function that the subject is aware of and complains about. This is in comparison to a decline assessed in an objective test like the Mini Mental State Exam or the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. The authors of this paper single it out as a precursor to dementia and point that maybe we focus too much on participants age 65 and more in previous studies. Their sample in this paper includes participants aged 50 to 70 in an attempt to better characterize subjective memory decline in this less represented population. More specifically, how well does subjective cognitive decline correlate with dementia in this group? They involved close to 6,200 participants and over 680 practitioners in Germany and asked them 2 simple yes or no questions about their subjective difficulties with memory. In the following 17 years, over 490 of the participants received a dementia diagnosis. Those who initially struggled with short-term memory were more likely to develop dementia within 9 years with an odds ratio of 1.8. We dig a little into different subtypes, but I know you're here for Alzheimer's, so here we go. For Alzheimer's disease, they only found a significant correlation between the initial struggles with short-term memory and a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease in the first 6 years. Note that these positive findings were for short-term memory, but they did also look at long-term memory and found no significant results. I find this interesting. When I tell people I used to do research on Alzheimer's disease, I'd often hear things like, "I bet I have Alzheimer's. I always forget my keys at home." Or, "How do I know if my forgetfulness is normal or pathological? Do I have dementia?" Honestly, these are very good questions, and it can be tricky to distinguish normal forgetfulness from dementia and other confounders such as anxiety, distractibility, or lack of interest, or lack of attention. So now I know to say to my friends that if you're 50 to 70 years old and you feel like you forget things that have just occurred, you're likely to develop Alzheimer's disease in the next 6 years. And that is according to this one abstract I read, published in June 2022. Ha! We're not straying far with the next abstract, you'll see. But first, I'm going to take a few minutes to clarify the terminology. See, I promised you some intros here and there, huh? If you're new to the field, you may find yourself confused by terms like dementia or Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment, and I've seen them being thrown around interchangeably. However, they're definitely not the same. Dementia is an umbrella term for a syndrome that manifests as a loss in cognition that interferes with functioning. This is not only trouble with learning and remembering, but also can manifest as problems with language or reasoning. These impairments can have different etiology, and the most common one is Alzheimer's disease, claiming 60 to 80% of dementia cases. This is perhaps the reason why there may be some confusion around the distinction between them. People with Alzheimer's typically have trouble with memory that affects their function, so dementia. But not everyone with dementia has Alzheimer's. Other causes of dementia include vascular problems, such as repeated strokes, or can be due to Parkinson's dementia, which develops with time in people with Parkinson's disease, or it could be frontotemporal dementia, where the pathology is seen in the frontal and temporal lobes, and therefore affects personality and behavior. Mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, refers to impairments in cognition, and not always memory, and these don't necessarily affect function. Mild cognitive impairment presents itself with different pathologies, and the one type of MCI you may hear about the most in the context of Alzheimer's disease is, you guessed it, amnestic MCI, or AMCI. And that's in contrast to non-amnestic MCI, which affects cognitive skills other than memory. In AMCI, the patient is less able to form new memories. So we're talking about anterograde amnesia, without a big impact on their other cognitive or social abilities. Like I said earlier, 10 to 15% of them go on to developing Alzheimer's disease. So in research, you'll often see AMCI being described as prodromal AD. And you can understand how accurately detecting AMCI can be very useful in defining a prognosis for a patient. And this can help plan for management as well. This was the focus of the last paper that I presented, as well as the coming one, abstract number 3, titled Deficits in Spontaneous and Stimulus-Dependent Retrieval as an Early Sign of Abnormal Aging. It was published in Science Reports by Wyrzyszynski and Niedzwinska, who are both affiliated with Jagiellonia University in Poland. In this paper, the authors set on a mission to show that spontaneous retrieval is impaired in people with amnestic MCI and other preclinical stages of dementia. They show pictures to 27 participants with amnestic MCI and 27 healthy controls, and then they track their mind wandering. Oh gosh, I'd do so poorly on this, ha! Huh? Note that they qualify some of these pictures as being meaningful and other ones as being unmeaningful. Not sure in what way from the abstract alone, but this makes me want to read the paper. Note that they associate mind wandering with cued recall. So if you see a picture that's meaningful to you and it evokes past memories, your mind might wander to go back to those memories. They found that those with amnestic MCI wandered less than healthy controls when they were presented with meaningful pictures, especially when these evoked memories from their past. However, their mind did not wander less or more with unmeaningful pictures. The authors find that this makes a compelling case for the decline in cue-driven processes early on in the progression of dementia, and that this can be used as a marker to detect amnestic MCI. Oof! So my incessant mind wandering during exams may mean that 1, the content is meaningful to me, and 2, that I'm faring well on cued recall. Talk about silver linings, hey? More on cued recall with the next abstract in this category, with a focus on the French population with Down syndrome, coming right after a couple of announcements.
Hi, dear listener. This is Nyla, host and co-founder here at Aminder. I've been hosting with the team since 2020, and not only has this taught me a lot about Alzheimer's disease, but I've also learned a lot about my inability to articulate words and to keep a consistent distance from the microphone. I apologize for that. But overall, it's been a really rewarding experience and one that we would love to share with you. If you'd like to take a deep dive into Alzheimer's research and science communication, then I've got good news for you. We're currently recruiting new hosts and content creators for the podcast. just email us at aminderpodcast@gmail.com or contact us through our social media pages and tell us a little bit about yourself. Looking forward to working with you soon.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years, and sadly, no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration and Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
Did you know that individuals with Down syndrome are at higher risk of developing Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia? And do you know why? Here's a hint. It has to do with the extra chromosome 21 characteristic of Down syndrome. A gene on it codes for a protein that you may hear about a lot in Alzheimer's research. And that's none other than APP, or amyloid precursor protein itself. APP goes on to be cleaved by beta and gamma sarcoglycans into amyloid beta, which aggregates and forms plaques, one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. So it makes sense that a person with an additional copy of this gene is at a higher risk of forming those aggregates, seen as early as 40 years of age in autopsied brains. According to the Alzheimer's Association, as many as 30% of people with Down syndrome in their 50s have Alzheimer's. I took a quick look at the facts and figures from 2020. The lowest age range for the general population was 65 to 74 and show a 3% prevalence of Alzheimer's disease. That's for the general population, right? And that's a big jump for the 30% that we see among the younger population with Down syndrome. Oh wait, if we adjust for age, people with Down syndrome in their 60s show a prevalence for Alzheimer's disease of 50%. Here you go. And why am I talking about Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease? More in abstract number 4, titled Modified Cued Recall Test in the French Population with Down Syndrome, a Retrospective Medical Record Analysis. You'll find it in the Journal of Intellectual Disability Research by first author Sacco, last author Rebilla, who are affiliated with Institut Jérôme Lejeune in France and EXYSTAT in France as well. In this retrospective study of medical records, the authors put the spotlight on the French version of the modified cued recall test. How well does it detect Alzheimer's disease in people with Down syndrome? They conducted an analysis of medical records from 2014 to 2020 and included patients 30 years and older with Down syndrome who had taken the modified cued recall test at least once. Close to 200 participants fit their criteria, of whom 12 had Alzheimer's disease, 94 had comorbidities that may impact cognition, and 88 were, so to say, cognitively healthy. Those with Alzheimer's disease scored lower than control, and the authors identified the optimal score cutoff as 22, which is close to the cutoff of 23 used in the English version of this test. Higher age and the severity of intellectual disability were factors that decreased scores. In conclusion, the authors praised the modified cue recall test as a sensitive test to detect Alzheimer's disease among people with Down syndrome, with a focus on the French version of this tool. If you're interested in validating translations of existing tests, I cover a couple of papers on this every month. The last abstract in our category on learning and memory is mostly about frontotemporal dementia, but I will only highlight the findings related to Alzheimer's disease. Abstract number 5 is titled The Disentangling Reversal Learning Impairments in Frontotemporal Dementia and Alzheimer's Disease. It was published in Cognitive Behavioral Neurology by first author Ahmed, last author Finger. And they're all based in Canada, all the authors, affiliated with Parkwood Institute Research, University of Western Ontario, and Ontario Shores Centre for Mental Health Sciences. The authors of this paper rely on a reversal learning paradigm to detect aspects of reversal learning that are specifically affected in Alzheimer's disease and frontotemporal dementia. They believe that these elements lead to poor decision-making, leading to a decline in executive function as well as neurobehavioral symptoms. 30 participants with frontotemporal dementia or Alzheimer's disease and 18 healthy controls underwent a stimulus discrimination reversal learning task. Those with Alzheimer's disease seemed to show impairment in the initial stimulus association learning. Those with frontotemporal dementia did as well, but to a lesser extent. The authors report more findings in the abstract, but all related to frontotemporal dementia. Since this is beyond our scope, if you're interested in frontotemporal dementia too, I'll let you enjoy the pleasure of reading the full abstract of the paper itself to quench your curiosity. The results of the study may inform future screening approaches or even treatments to target behavioral symptoms that are associated with the impairment of stimulus reinforcement learning. This was the perfect gateway to our next section on executive function. This category is occupied by only one paper this month, titled Cognitive Correlates of Impaired Testamentary Capacity in Alzheimer's Dementia. This is abstract number 6, and it was published in Archives in Clinical Neuropsychology. The first author, Gerstenecker. Last author is Marson. And they're affiliated with the University of Alabama at Birmingham and Tuscaloosa Veterans Administration in Tuscaloosa, all in the U.S. Testament capacity, huh? I've never encountered a paper on this, but I have encountered it in the context of ethical considerations with patients with dementia. Legally, testament capacity describes the ability to make or edit a will. In the context of Alzheimer's disease, you may see how decline in cognition can pose problems in financial and medical contexts. When does one stop being legally competent to make these decisions? To measure testament capacity, the authors elected a new tool called the Testament Capacity Instrument. They administered it to 20 individuals with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease and 22 healthy controls, in addition to a battery of neuropsychological tests. They found that all but one of the individuals with Alzheimer's had lower scores than the healthy controls by more than 2.5 standard deviation. They also identified three cognitive correlates for testament capacity, which are the following: verbal memory, executive function, and semantic knowledge. They conclude that living with Alzheimer's disease comes with an impairment in testament capacity, warranting that we look at this aspect of functioning in our assessments. Now, the last paper in this episode takes us to another neurocognitive domain, and that is perceptual and motor skills. We're almost there, my friend. Just one more abstract. And this one is titled Clinical Screening for Posterior Cortical Atrophy. It was published in Cognitive Behavioral Neurology by first author Mendez, last author Zierstein, and they're affiliated with David Geffen School of Medicine in LA, Veterans Affairs in Greater Los Angeles, and Lahey Hospital and Medical Center in Burlington, Massachusetts. Posterior cortical atrophy, or PCA, is, as the name suggests, a gradual degeneration of the cortex, mostly in the posterior part. And as you may guess, it affects the processing of visual information. But how does this relate to Alzheimer's disease? Thanks to the Alzheimer's Association website, I've recently learned that PCA may present with amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in the affected areas. Huh. Where else do we hear about plaques and tangles? Is it possible that PCA is really Alzheimer's disease? Unclear yet, Some sources describe it as a visual variant of Alzheimer's disease, while others point that plaques and tangles are seen outside of the context of Alzheimer's. So PCA could be its own thing. The authors of abstract number 7 seem of the mind that PCA falls under the Alzheimer's disease category, and they tried to single out neurobehavioral screening tasks. They tested 12 people with PCA, 12 with Alzheimer's disease, and 24 healthy controls on a long list of tasks. And these include, not limited to, complex figure copying, color identification, figure ground discrimination, global local processing, dressing apraxia, and many more. They found that those with PCA showed more marked impairment on many of these tasks than those with Alzheimer's disease. Specifically, to screen for PCA, they highlight the figure ground discrimination task and specific tasks for Bayland syndrome and dressing limb apraxia. So these are tests that can help you screen PCA specifically. They also conclude that PCA is a disorder of the occipital parietal cortex that affects vision and spatial motor skills. I wonder what all this means for the categorization of PCA within or without the umbrella of Alzheimer's disease. Are they part of a continuum or completely different? What do you think? Is this an Alzheimer's disease paper? I don't know, but we included it. Bonus for you. And with this, I conclude this episode on neurocognitive domains in testing for Alzheimer's disease. Thank you for sticking around till the end. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed hosting it. You can find the bibliography for this in the show notes. If you go to our site, aminder.com, and click on bibliography at the top of the page, you'll be redirected to our drive where we keep all past bibliographies. We update it as we release episodes and also add the bibliographies for the topics that we do not cover. Like I said in earlier, every month we download all the abstracts with the word Alzheimer in them. We categorize them and we assign those categories to hosts depending on their area of interest and expertise. Those are 38 categories. Naturally, many of these do not get covered, and we'd love to recruit more people who care about SciComm and want an extra incentive to keep up with the news in their field. Topics that are up for grabs include amyloid beta aggregation, fluid biomarkers, oxidative stress, and more. So if you study Alzheimer's disease and want to try your hand at podcasting, please get in touch. You don't have to host episodes to join us. You could help with many other things like audio editing, which is super easy. No experience needed to join the team for that. It's a cool skill to acquire. Isn't that so, Michelle? Yeah, Michelle is editing my episodes, so I just want to give her a shout out here. We have room in our bibliography team, sorting, advertising, funding, and more. So get in touch. Aside from the experience, you also get to interact with scientists from all around the world. We have team members from 6 different time zones working consistently to bring you episodes 3 times a week. So thank you to the amazing team that we have. I want to specifically thank Joseph Liang for reviewing my script and Michelle Grover for editing the audio. I kid you not. Poor thing, I give her the messiest audio when I record, and a lot of noises, and she's cleaning it up really nicely for you. So thank you, Michelle. And my co-manager, Dr. Ellen Kosh, got a very nice ring to it. Dr. Ellen Kosh, who recently successfully defended her PhD and happens to be the co-manager at Aminder, is doing some quality control of this episode. So thank you for everyone who comes together to make this happen. Know that we all do this on a voluntary basis on top of school, research, jobs, and our personal life, but we're super proud of where we got. However, we also know there's always room for improvement, so make sure you let us know if there's anything we can do better. If you like what we do, Don't hold back. Hearing from you is the fuel that keeps us going. You can help us by leaving a review on your podcast app or giving us a shout out on social media. Just make sure you tag us so we can thank you. We're active on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Make sure you connect with us there. I'll be waiting to hear from you. I hope you found this podcast useful and accessible. Until next time.